Then they said, okay, we've got to cut back on prescriptions that we're providing, and we need to develop a system where doctors can interact with each other and know which patients have been getting which types of opioid, right? Because what you saw happen because of the addiction process is doctor shopping, right? If one doctor doesn't give me the medicine, then I'm going to go to another doctor, or I'm going to go into the emergency room, right? And because they're addicted, they have a substance use disorder now, a chemical imbalance that's telling them they need this drug. The PDMP program still is very effective in reducing prescription opioids, but what do you do with those people that are already addicted? Now you have a community, numerous people who have substance use disorders. So where are they going to go for those drugs?
From PHI Media, I'm Gordon Thane. And this is The Story of the Opioid Epidemic, Episode 215, The Three Waves.
You're listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for all things public health and global health, from the Sustainable Development Goals to the social determinants of health, as well as interesting dialogues about the diverse career opportunities that exist in these fields. Remember to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so other people like you can benefit from our content.
There are many stories out there about how the opioid crisis has now become one of the greatest public health challenges of our time. Some stories are more accurate than others, but to get to the truth and truly understand the current opioid crisis, we must go back in time. What you're about to hear is my conversation with Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia about a chronological timeline of the opioid epidemic, including the evolution of opioid use and marketing, the introduction of synthetic opioids, and the complexity of opioid overdose reversals due to an increased use of the unpredictable street supply. Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia is the Director of Justice and Public Health Policy and Practice for WestEd's Justice and Prevention Research Center. She's also an adjunct associate professor for the Bovard College at the University of Southern California, where she teaches systems thinking to solve complex public health and criminal justice issues. She brings over 20 years of experience working in justice, public health, and the community settings, and has led discussions on Capitol Hill about substance misuse, prevention, and criminal justice reform. It is now widely accepted that the modern opioid epidemic progressed over three distinct waves. But the real story begins when opioids were first discovered, when morphine and heroin were first developed, how they were used historically over time, and the transition to non-opioid pain relievers.
I mean, we got to go clear back to the 18th century when we look at this. And it's really important for folks to understand this history. Morphine was probably one of the first analgesics that we were looking at in terms of painkillers. And you're looking at the Revolutionary War, right? So it was, you know, obviously through the war times, you've got a lot of horrific injuries, horrific pain. So morphine was introduced. And into the Civil War, even into the 1800s, and heroin was introduced as well as another painkiller. And in fact, heroin was even used for children's colds, right? It was a widely used drug that even was given to minors just to treat minor ailments.
It was just standard, just accepted, nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, it was a painkiller. It's a very effective. Morphine, heroin, I mean, very effective painkillers. And then what we found, obviously, early 20th century, is the addiction, right? How substance use disorders are developed through the, you know, morphine and heroin. And obviously research came out around the addiction of these two. So then you had non-opioid analgesics developed, like ibuprofen, Tylenol, Motrin, all of those kind of different painkillers that were non-opioid related. So then you started seeing a little bit of that fall off of the use of morphine and heroin, obviously more so heroin, but morphine was used in more of a clinical hospital setting. But just for the common day pain ailments, you had more of the Tylenol, ibuprofen, right, that were not addictive. Not as effective, but not as addictive. But then you have to think about, okay, we're living longer, mm-hmm. right? We live longer than we did in the 18th, 19th, even the early 20th century, right? And people have chronic pain.
Right.
As we get older, we have more ailments, we have more disease, we have more pain. So what happened then in the kind of the late, I want to say 1980s, early 1990s, is we had the production of OxyContin started coming out.
The first wave of the opioid epidemic began in the 1990s and was driven by a change in the approach to treating pain. And this was against the economic and social backdrop that existed at this time. All of this culminated in a significant increase in opioid prescriptions, which started to peak at around 2011. More prescriptions meant more people were taking the drug and ultimately becoming more dependent on it, which inevitably led to a rise in overdoses and death.
We had the production of some of these more, not morphine, obviously not heroin, but we had more synthetic opioids being developed for pain relief. And we also had then Big Pharma marketing these opioids as non-addictive. So folks like medical doctors, they were getting all of this information from their pharmaceutical reps. Oh, we've got these new synthetic opioids. They are non-addictive. It's not like morphine. It's not like what we've seen in the past. It's safe to use with your patients, so forth and so on. And we had this big influx of prescription opioids, of synthetic opioids.
Just a quick question before you jump there. So just to make sure I have it right, it's a bit counterintuitive to what maybe I thought way back when I started learning about this, where we started off with the opioid-based analgesics. It's kind of realized the addictive properties. Then the phasing out of that coincides with the phasing in and development of the non-opioid analgesics like acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and that sort of thing. And then it sort of tails off for a while. Commonly accepted that if you're going to treat pain, you use the non-opioid pain medications. I guess if it's very severe pain in a hospital setting, depending on the ailment, maybe doctors have the discretion to use the opioids. But then that's kind of how the space that it lived in for a while. And then you're bringing in that the first wave where the drug opioids was redeveloped and repackaged as something that was supposedly non-addictive. And then that kind of kicks us off to what you're about to get into.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. It's kind of this up and down of the use of these opioids and then non-opioid analgesics, and then the pharmacy and the big pharma producing synthetic opioids, and then the marketing of it. And then not just OxyContin, that was probably the primary opioid in the late 90s into the early 2000s.
Well, if overprescribing caused a problem in the first place, then why not make doctors prescribe less and have some kind of a system to make sure that fraudulent or irregular prescribing behaviors are being monitored? Why didn't simply doing less of what caused a problem ended up fixing it?
It just continues to go back to the marketing of this. Once we understood that, oh my gosh, these drugs are so addictive, create such a pathway for substance use disorders, that we started training doctors, and we're starting to say, hey, medical doctors, we can't prescribe these on every little pain ailment for everybody who's coming in. We need to provide alternatives to manage chronic pain. And the training really started to happen. And when we really started understanding the addictive characteristics, then we started implementing things called prescription drug monitoring programs, PDMPs for short, right? And that's been very effective in its own little silo or its own little bucket, because once doctors got the actual facts, the research facts, right? Not the marketing facts, I say in air quotes, not the marketing facts. Then they said, okay, we've got to cut back on prescriptions that we're providing, and we need to develop a system where doctors can interact with each other and know which patients have been getting which types of opioid, because what you saw happen because of the addiction process is doctor shopping, right? If one doctor doesn't give me the medicine, then I'm going to go to another doctor, or I'm going to go into the emergency room, right? And because they're addicted, they have a substance use disorder now, a chemical imbalance that's telling them they need this drug. The PDMP program still is very effective in reducing prescription opioids, but what do you do with those people that are already addicted? Now you have a community, numerous people who have substance use disorders, so where are they going to go for those drugs?
To a large degree, the opioid crisis was created and is being sustained by a supply and demand problem. As doctors no longer prescribed opioids at the first sign of pain, pharmaceutical-grade pills became less available. There was so much demand created from the first wave that the cat could no longer go back in the bag, so to speak. There was already a large population experiencing addiction to opioids. With one of the supply chains being cut off, it's reasonable that someone might turn to a new supplier and maybe even find a different product that functions in a similar way. The problem here is, while you know exactly how much of an active ingredient is in something when you get it from the pharmacy, the street supply is way more inconsistent and unpredictable.
If you can't get them from the doctor, they're going to go to the streets. They're not going to care who you are, where you come from, you're going to the streets to get it. Just because we reduce the prescriptions, which is great, that's a great outcome, we still have substance use disorder to deal with within folks, they're going to the streets to get it illegally. And then that's what perpetrated where we are at today with now, oh, we have a new market of people who are already addicted, so let's start bringing the drugs into the country, right? Let's start putting them into other pills. Let's get it into cocaine. Let's get it into, you know, the different pills that kids are taking. And that's where we are at in this wave.
So the first wave is characterized by an increase in prescribing from the overall marketing tactics of some big pharma players. Then it sounds like it got introduced into markets where it didn't really need to be, for simple pain and maybe low, moderate pain. And then because it was so in every corner and every person might have experienced it, then you pull the narcotic monitoring systems or the different systems that are out there to monitor prescribing practices from doctors. But you already established a market that depending on the drugs, and you created a system or an opportunity for a black market where, because the regular doctor pharmacy pipeline has started to shut off, there was an opportunity for other players to get in who are more nefarious on the nefarious side. Eventually, heroin became the main way that people were first introduced to consuming opioids, marking a shift away from prescription pills during the first wave and clearly marking the progression of the second wave, including a rise in bloodborne disease transmission from intravenous injection, which now became the more common way to consume rather than through oral ingestion. A closer look reveals that this wave was characterized by young people transitioning from opioid pills to heroin due to this growing dependence, which required a larger and more consistent pill supplies than they could ordinarily get through prescriptions or from the street. In this regard, heroin was widely available and happened to be cheaper. In late 2010, OxyContin was reformulated such that it was more difficult to consume it in ways other than which it was originally intended.
But then you get even into the more 2000s, in 2005, 10, 15, we have this introduction of fentanyl, which is another opioid pain reliever. But the issue and how we're getting into kind of the current wave of this epidemic and why it's so prevalent is because fentanyl is 100 times more potent and lethal than morphine. And it's that much more addictive, that much more has the ability to create a substance use disorder.
The third wave of the opioid epidemic began in roughly 2013 and is characterized by this emergence of synthetic opioids, in particular, fentanyl, which became ever-present in the heroin supply. Because fentanyl can be very strong in small amounts, its presence in the street supply of products, like heroin, led to a surge in overdose mortality. The market for illicitly manufactured fentanyl continued to change, and it can be found in combination with heroin, counterfeit pills, cocaine, and many other different products.
It literally changes the way that our brain functions in terms of it tells us we need this drug to live. Mm-hmm. That it literally changes that brain chemistry. And folks then have to take more and more. They build up tolerance to it faster, and they need more and more because the body and the brain is telling them, I need this to live. It's almost like air that we breathe. It's almost like that feeling of if you stopped breathing for a minute, you have to have air to live. That's the feeling that this fentanyl gives us. And so that's where we get the difference of, you know, we kind of had a first epidemic back in the Civil War with morphine and heroin, if you want to look at it that way. But we changed, we made alternatives, that epidemic slowed. But now we are in this epidemic, and I'm going to say an overdose epidemic, because fentanyl, of how potent and lethal it is in terms of mortality. Mm-hmm. So that's really where we're headed. Well, we are already into the midst of, and where we've been heading since 2010 and on.
One of the key differences there, it sounds like, it, because fentanyl wasn't available during the times of the war, is that morphine was being used.
Right.
So it was a different context, too, in terms of the potency and the addictive property of the drugs that were available at that time. And now we're in a modern day reality of fentanyl. And I think one other piece that I'd want you to talk to as well is, maybe I'm wrong about this, but back then I'm assuming that there's these pharmaceutical companies that are the ones manufacturing the opioids for it to be prescribed. And then in the modern context now we have, you know, illicit markets that are producing these non-pharmaceutical grade drugs, which introduces another layer of complexity to this overdose crisis, as you call it.
Exactly. And I'll add to that, Gordon, the fentanyl, because it's 100 times more potent than morphine and other opioids, it gives you more of a euphoria, right? When you, and especially when you first start taking it, it gives you that euphoric feeling. You feel great, right? It also has a lot of side effects as well. But it's a drug that people like to take because of the feeling that it gives you, right? But then again, that starts with the changing of the brain chemistry and then building tolerance and then needing more and more and more. But so that's another kind of layer to it too, is that this fentanyl is just so potent, and then the way that it makes us feel.
Right?
People want more and more and more of it. But then I love how you brought up to the dangers of where we are at in this current wave. We're seeing 130 people per day overdosing, right? Most of that is through fentanyl. The greater percentage of that is through fentanyl. But we see this wave coming through college campuses, high schools, younger kids, but then also older folks, 45, 50, 60 years old as well. Because we just don't know what we're taking. When we get into the college campuses, we get into the high schools, kids are at parties, fraternity parties, whatever it might be, and they're passing around pills, right? And they might be thinking they're taking one thing, but it's laced with fentanyl, and they're overdosing immediately because there's, I'm pretty sure that the folks that are making these synthetic drugs are not monitoring how much is going into the drugs,
right? Right.
They're just mixing it. They're just cutting it because the greater that they can cut the drug and produce, then they can sell more. Right? So they're not interested in that. And then I'm going to throw one more thing at you with xylazine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Since it was first introduced, fentanyl has remained the leading cause of opioid overdoses and death due to its potent nature and the fact that there's no way of confirming its presence or absence in a product without testing. Things got even more complicated as the street supply became laced with even more adulterants. Adulterants are substances that are added to drugs or other substances to increase the quantity or weight of the product, often resulting in reduced quality or purity. In the context of drug use, adulterants can include harmful or unknown substances mixed with drugs, leading to potentially dangerous effects on the individuals consuming them. These adulterants being present in the street supply complicates the effectiveness of the harm reduction tools that we have at our disposal for opioid overdose reversals.
that's part of this current wave. So we have, yes, we have the overdoses and we have Narcan. It's an antagonist to the opioid, so it literally blocks it and reverses it immediately, right? And reverses the overdose and saves lives. But when you add this drug called xylazine to the mix and cut that into the pills or whatever the person is taking, whether it's through a syringe or through a pill, the xylazine is a horse tranquilizer. And it's literally being put into these pills. And so when someone's being brought out of the overdose through Narcan, they're literally tranquilized. And so they can't move, they can't, you know, it represses their respiratory system, right? And so the Narcan is therefore ineffective. So it's just another layer of what we're dealing with this current wave. And so it was another drug that created that euphoria, created that high, and folks were learning about that. And then obviously I'm going to use Gordon's terms, the nefarious marketers, yeah. I like that term, then started adding that in too, because it was another drug that created a high.
I think what we see here in Canada too is benzodiazepines, the benzos, also being mixed in, complicating opioid overdose reversals too. As well, in terms of the overall harm reduction approach, bringing that to the broader public, we've just since done a good job of like opioid overdose, Narcan works, carry Narcan, great. And then that's complicated by the factors that you mentioned where it might not work entirely if there's some other issues complicating breathing or how someone might be resuscitated. And that's making the life of the everyday civilian who wants to play a role in maybe saving someone's life very difficult. And I think one thing I learned about the other day too is there's apparently two more drugs that are being found in the street supply as well. It's metoclopramide and dexmedetomidine, which makes it, I don't know what they do or what the nature of those chemicals are. I just remember seeing like a drug alert like we have in Canada, a couple of drug alerts, and we have different drug checking surveillance systems that identify unknown substances, and it just becomes almost like an arms race with like the tools that we have to use to work against what we're seeing on the street. We can't evolve as quickly as the complicated supply, so it makes life very difficult.
It makes our job in public health very difficult, especially in this field, right? I wrote those two.
Yeah, I'll have to send you the. I think
down,
I
botched it. Yeah, send them to me.
I think I botched the names of them, but.
I wrote them down, but send them to me. But I think the point too to take away from this with not just fentanyl, but xylazine, benzodiazepines, and the other two drugs that you just mentioned is that we're behind. And as long as our nefarious marketers can continue to sell and make money, a lot of money, right? They're going to continue to create ways to keep people addicted, create that substance use disorder cycle, because that's where the money's made, right? And the more folks that we can bring into the addiction cycle, the better for that marketing and that money making. And I know we're going to get into systems thinking here, but we've got to start thinking through the ways that we think through a systems lens to get these outcomes. How do we work together and not just in our own silos of practice?
So a question popped in my head as we had this part of the conversation about one of the things that I hear from a lot of folks is even the framing of the crisis. So opioid toxicity, don't call it an overdose. Is it overdose? Is it? And then the latest one is drug policy crisis versus an opioid overdose crisis specifically. Is there a point in this progression of the three waves and the current phase that we're in now where you would say it's more categorized by a drug policy crisis? Because we're talking about your background with the criminology and the punitive ways of how we see people use substances and possession. At what point did we realize that the policies at the government level were now actually probably doing more harm than we thought? The Sacklers are the bad guys, Purdue's the bad guy. But when did the policies become sort of the bad guy? Coming up next, the final episode in this three-part mini-series with Dr. Jennifer Loeffler-Cobia. where we discuss the impact of policies on worsening the opioid crisis and the value of adopting a systems thinking approach with various stakeholders in generating effective long-term solutions for the opioid epidemic. That's next time on the story of the opioid epidemic on the Public Health Insight podcast. This show was edited by me, Gordon Thane, with additional editing from LaShawn Benedict. Sound design and mixing by myself and LaShawn Benedict. The original music from The Music Room, composed by Tom Fox, licensed from Johnny Harris. The cover art design for our show by LaShawn Benedict. The Public Health Insight podcast is produced by PHI Media. Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. See you in the next one.